Welcome, friend. Welcome to the temple of the dividend discount models. Here you will learn the secrets of discounted cash flows and present values. And you will know more than virtually all other investors out there. You will be the guru of present value. Yeah, well, all right, I apologize, you know, gotta try to make things interesting. But in truth, most all investors really don't think of their investments as a discounted cash flow, as a series of monies coming back at them. And you're going to learn how to do that. Will it make you a better investor? I certainly hope so. In fact, I believe that knowing this tilts the odds in your favor. Will you be the next Peter Lynch, the next Warren Buffett? I hope so. I'm hoping one of my students goes on to become the next Peter Lynch. Because it ain't me. I'm not him. So I'm hoping someone, one of you will become. But I do believe that the dividend discount models, as I said, tilt the odds in your favor. Now, let's get started. Slide number 17. Dividend discount models use the idea that shares of stock are valued on the basis of the present value of the future dividend streams the stock is projected to produce. Huh? In other words, this stock is going to pay us dividends. What are those dividends worth to us? It goes by various names, dividend valuation models, discounted cash flow models, which I actually prefer, discounted cash flow model. That's my favorite term. Recall from our previous session that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows. Okay, therefore, dividend discount models should be extremely popular, right? Well, during the 1990s, during the huge run-up, investors who adhered to these types of models were considered old-fashioned, outdated fuddy-duddies. Dividends? What? I want capital gains. And that was the mantra. We wanted the stock price to go up. Don't pay me dividends. Reinvest the money back in the company and grow the company. But those investors who hung on to the dividend discount models and dividends in general weathered the 2000 to 2002 downturn very well. Dividends have become important again. Now, did it help them in 2008? No. They went down like everybody else, but not as much as the growth folks who were not thinking about dividends. But still, everybody, all fall down. Slide number 18. Here's the dividend discount model in its purest incarnation. And remember that in Chapter 6, they put this at the beginning of the chapter. The value of the stock is equal to the present value of all expected future dividend payments. Now, there's a scary formula, but really all it's telling you is that our present value, what it's worth to us today, P sub zero, zero meaning time and years, to the present date, is equal to the dividend from year number 1 divided by 1 plus K. Well, what is K? K is our required rate of return. In other words, what we're looking for. Are we looking for 8%? Are we looking for 6%? Are we looking for 12%? That's what K stands for. I wish they used something else because in baseball, K stands for strikeout. But anyway, dividend in the first year divided by 1 plus K. The 1 plus 6%, 8%, 10%. You decide what your required rate of return is. And then the dividend for year number 2 divided by 1 plus the required rate of return squared. and then the dividend for year number 3 divided by 1 plus k to the third power, and so on and so forth throughout how many years you are looking ahead. And that's all that scary formula looks like. On page 183 of the 6th edition, and it's about the same place in all the other editions, so if you have the 3rd, 4th, or 5th, you will see an example that shows 3 annual dividends of $100 per share. And then the company promptly goes out of business. That's sort of a ridiculous example, but that's the example they use. And the required rate of return for our intrepid investor is 15%. Now, folks, should you ever consider 15% to be reasonable? I don't, but that's me. I think that's a little much to ask out of a stock, but some people, that's what they're after. So we take the first dividend in year number 1, $100, divided by 1 plus 15%, 1.15. And then we take the second dividend in the year number 2, divided by 1.15 squared. And then we take the third dividend in year number 3, divided by 1.15 to the third power. And for those of you who don't mind exponents, if you do that calculation, you wind up with $228.32. So, if we knew we were going to get 3 annual dividends of $100 each year, and we required 15% as our required rate of return, what we're looking for, we would be willing to pay $228.32 for that stock. That's what that stock is worth to us. That's the present value. But how many companies pay 3 annual dividends and then go out of business, huh? Plus, we keep using this term, present value. What does present value mean? Slide number 19. Present value is the value today of a lump sum or series of payments to be received at some future date. It is the opposite of future value. It's the inverse. Now, I didn't require you to do this, but remember back in chapter 1, the optional future value calculations? And if you've taken or you're taking the Business 121 class, we worked on these together in class. In the personal finance class, we are very interested in the future value of our investments. Here, because we've gone way beyond that, we're interested in the present value. In other words, what is it worth to us today? So if you look at this formula, and you don't have to know the formulas, we use the tables. What's the future value of $10,000, this is a single payment, in 10 years at 8%? Well, there's the formula, 1 plus 8% to the 10th power. And it turns out it's worth $21,589. If we had $10,000, put it in an investment that earned 8%, in 10 years we'd have $21,589. So what's the present value of $21,589 in 10 years at 8%? In other words, if we knew we were going to get $21,589 in 10 years, and we were requiring an 8% rate of return, that's what we're happy with, then that value is worth to us $10,000 today. So what would you rather have, $10,000 today or $21,589 in 10 years? If you are happy with an 8% rate of return, then it doesn't matter. They are equal. That's the two sides of the coin. Present value tells you what it's worth today. Future value tells you what it's worth in the future. And in finance, present value tells us what the future value is worth today. So, slide number 20. Did the formula for the dividend discount model scare you? Well, this formula has the present value calculation built into it. The 1 plus the rate of return to the power of whatever year we're discussing. We mortals simply use the present value tables just as we used the future value tables back in chapter 1. And the formula then becomes the dividend for year number 1 times the present value multiplier for year number 1 plus the dividend for year number 2 times the present value multiplier for year number 2 plus the dividend for year number 3 times the present value multiplier for year number 3 and so forth and so on. And some of you more math inclined might say, well, what difference does it make? Why not just use the exponent? But it's more work, plus it's scarier for some people. So I'm going to ask you to go to the website and print out so that you have in your hot little hands, or if you have a big enough screen, you could just leave it on the screen, the present value tables. Slide number 21. Let's do the same example over again. Using the present value multipliers from the present value table on the class website. So there's the link. Print it out and have it in your hot little hands. And there's one in the book, so if you want to open, if you have the book handy, open up the book. Three annual dividends of $100 per share, required rate of return 15%. So how do we do it now? We take the $100 dividend that we're going to get the first year, and then we multiply it times 0.870. Now, where'd you get that? I want you to print out the table. If you haven't done so, pause the presentation. Go across to 15%, down 1 year, and you will see that the present value multiplier is 0.87. So what is $100 a year from now worth to us today if our required rate of return is 15%? It's worth $87. That's what that's telling us. It's a very simple calculation, and the concept's a little tricky, but not if you think, okay, what would you rather have today, $87, or would you rather have $100 a year from now? Well, if you have a required rate of return of 15%, you don't care. They're the same. 2 years from now, at 15%, the present value multiplier is 0.756. Now go check. Go across 15% down to 2 years, and you'll see 0.756. You see that? So you multiply the $100 we're going to receive 2 years from now times the 0.756, and we get $75.60. What would you rather have, $100 today or $75.60 2 years from now? If your required rate of return, I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Would you rather have $75.60 today or $100 in 2 years? If our required rate of return is 15%, they are equivalent. And then so on for the third year. $100 times the present value multiplier for 15% for 3 years. Go across 15%, down 3 years, and you'll see it's 0.658. You add those three numbers together, and you get $228.40, which is very similar to $228.32. Why is it 8 cents off? Because our tables don't have as much precision as our calculators. So, 8 cents. What's the difference? All right? What is the present value of the future stream of dividends? At 15%, $100 in 1 year is worth $87. In 2 years, $75.60. In 3 years, $65.80. The sum of the present values of the future dividend cash flows equals our perceived value of the stock. And it's something that some students just refuse to do. I don't understand. I think it's part of the new religion of students. I don't care what the professor tells me to do. My religion tells me I can't study. You need to do this. Okay, so do it. Pause the presentation if you have to. And use the present value table to do that problem. Because we're going to come back to it over and over again. Slide 22. Let us now take a look at some of the variations of the dividend discount model. The one we just looked at is the purest form. But here is the zero growth model, which is, by the way, not covered in our book. It assumes dividends will continue at a fixed rate indefinitely into the future. And so how do we value a stock that is going to pay us the same dividend forward into the future? Well, we could go through all those machinations that we just did, or we just say the value of the stock is equal to the annual dividends divided by the required rate of return. That's it. So if we knew that we were going to get $3 per share in perpetuity, I love that word, perpetuity means forever. You get to spit on your friends when you say in perpetuity. And our required rate of return was 6%. Then we would take the $3 that we're going to get in perpetuity, divide it by 0.06, 6%, and we would be willing to pay $50 per share for this stock. Now, does this look familiar? Yes, it's simply another way to view dividend yield from Chapter 5. So let's go to slide number 23 and see that the value of the stock, from according to the formula, is equal to our annual dividends divided by the required rate of return. Well, if you go back to Chapter 5, you'll see that dividend yield is equal to the annual dividends divided by the market price of the stock. So they're very, very similar in that we're saying the value of the stock is equal to the annual dividends divided by the required rate of return. And so what the dividend yield does is just flip the value of the stock, puts it down here. It's the market price, what people are currently paying. And the required rate of return is the dividend yield. And if you don't understand what the similarities, it's not that big a deal. Don't worry about it. Just make sure you can do the calculation. But it essentially is saying investors who emphasize the zero growth model are valuing the stock almost exclusively for its dividend yield. In other words, we care not if the stock is ever going to rise in value. We are interested simply in the dividend that this stock produces. And what kind of stocks meet this criteria? Utilities. Utilities are excellent, excellent candidates, excellent examples for the zero growth model. Why? Because most utilities are not growing very fast, if at all. Sure, they're pumping out the gas and electric or whatever utility it is. But unless the area that they work in is growing quickly, they're not growing that fast. So here's a real life example of a company called Consolidated Edison. Have you heard of them? Right, it's the it's the electric company for New York City. Been around for 130 some odd years or something. And their current market price is $56.58 as of February 15, 2013. They're currently paying $2.46 per year in annual dividends and have been doing so for quite some time. The question is, for you, or for any investor, what is our required rate of return? So let's say we expect to get 8%. That's what we're after. We take the annual dividend, $2.46, and divide it by 8%. And we get $30.75. So for us, for our required rate of return, the stock is overpriced. We're trying to get 8%, but this stock is not yielding that for us. We would only pay $30.75 if we wanted 8%. Okay, so why don't we just lower our expectations, right? What about 5%? Well, there, the value is equal to the annual dividend of $2.46 divided by 5%. And that's $49.20. So at 5%, the stock is still too expensive for us if our required rate of return is 5%. With a market price of $56.50, the stock is yielding 4.4%. So in other words, investors who are happy with the price of the stock are happy with a 4.4% rate of return. Now, some of them might say, well, we think the stock is going to grow over the long term. I don't think they're going to be rewarded that way. I mean, as the economy does well throughout New York City, they should do reasonably well, but they're not growing very fast. The zero growth model works well for stable income producing stocks, and on the worksheets, you're going to see that these are always utilities. And on the assignment, you're going to see that it's a utility, and on, probably on the exam, you're going to see it's a utility. So if you see a utility, which model are you going to use? Can I make it any more plainer? Anyway, next model, slide number 25. This one's got a great name, constant perpetual growth model. Constant perpetual? That's redundant, isn't it? It comes to you from the Department of Redundancy Department. I often work there. Anyway, the constant perpetual growth model assumes dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate perpetually into the future. There's that word again, perpetuity, perpetually. And what you see, folks, if you look carefully, is that it's really the zero growth model. Annual dividends divided by required rate of return, but we've added these two expressions, we've added these two extra parts to add the idea that the dividends are growing, all right? So in the zero growth model, the dividends weren't growing, so we just took the annual dividends divided by the required rate of return. But here, the dividends are growing at a constant growth rate, and so we add to the annual dividends the multiplication of 1 plus the constant growth rate, and then we subtract the required rate of return in the denominator by the constant growth rate. So is it really that difficult a calculation? No, it is not. It is not that difficult, and you can do it. And here's the example from page 184 of our sixth edition, and it's very close in the other editions if you have those. If we're getting $10 a share this year, and we have seen or we expect this company to continue to raise their dividend at a 5% growth rate, we've seen them doing it for the last 4 or 5 years or 10 years or whatever, we assume that they will continue to do it, then we believe that next year they're going to be paying us $10.50, right? 1 plus 0.05. And our required rate of return, again, there's the book asking a 15% from stocks. I think that's a little much to ask from stocks, but there are some investors who shoot for 15%. I wish them good luck. $10 times 1.05, so the annual dividend times 1 plus the constant growth rate, 1 plus 0.05 or 1.05, divided by the required rate of return, 15%, minus the constant growth rate of 5%, so that's 0.15 minus 0.05, that's 0.1. And so we wind up with $10.50 divided by 0.01, 10%, and we believe the stock is worth $105. Now, if it were selling for less than that, yippee! Cool, we think the stock is worth $105, but it's actually selling for less. If it were selling for more, we'd say, oh, well, probably not a good investment for us, unless we're willing to lower our expectations. This formula is good for companies with consistent dividend growth rates. So, let's take a look at a company that you may have heard of with a consistent dividend growth rate, and that is Johnson & Johnson. Now, have you ever heard of Johnson & Johnson? Maybe not, but you sure do use their products. Band-Aids, Q-tips, baby shampoo and powder, Johnson's baby powder, What else? They make Tylenol. They make dozens and dozens of health-related medical equipment. They make medical equipment. They make stents. What are stents? Stents are those little tubes that they put in people's arteries to unblock the arteries. They're a venerable blue-chip company. They're a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. They've been paying dividends for over 100 years. Based in New Jersey, right? Yeah. And their current market price is $76.16 as of February 15th, 2013. They're currently paying $2.44 in annual dividends. And let us assume that dividends are growing around 8% per year. Okay, so let's assume that dividends have been growing at 8% per year. If we have a required rate of return of 13%, then when we plug the numbers into the formula, we get the annual dividend times 1 plus 8%. That's what we assume the growth rate is, 1.08, or 1 plus 8%, 1.08, divided by the 13% required rate of return minus 8%. That's 0.13 divided by, minus 0.05. That turns out to be roughly $2.6352. And, you know, you don't have to put all the numbers that your calculator spits out at you. Divided by 0.05, and we get $52.70. So, this is not a great buy for us if we require 13%, right? So, because it's selling for 76 bucks. But what if our required rate of return were only 10%? What if we said, well, we're happy with 10%? I don't know about you, but I'm happy with 10%. $2.28 times 1.08 divided by 10%. So that's the only thing that changes. Minus 8%, 0.10 minus 0.08. And we get that same 2.6352, but this time divided by 0.02. And the model says that Johnson & Johnson is worth to us $131.76. Wow. Note that this model is very sensitive to our choice of our required rate of return. And sometimes students will say to me, well, where do you get the required rate of return? And you get that from what you expect. In other words, there are millions of investors all around the world, and each one is requiring a different rate of return. Some are more aggressive investors, some are more conservative investors, and some are middle of the road. So that's where the required rate of return comes from. It comes from you. You decide what kind of rate of return you want. Do you think Johnson & Johnson is a good value? Would you buy Johnson & Johnson? Would you want to own this venerable blue chip company? You know, companies, folks, they're not stupid. What would you do? What would you give to have your name of your product make it into the language? Band-Aid, Q-tip, oh, Kleenex, Google, you, Xerox. You'd do anything. And Johnson & Johnson is one of those few rarefied companies that their names of their products are names in the English language. Slide 27. Here's another venerable. You like that word, venerable? I've been using it today for some odd reason. Blue chip company, Procter & Gamble. Now, you might not have heard of them. Well, of course you have. But you know all their products. Tide, Pampers, Head & Shoulders, Crest, Gillette. Yeah, Charmin, yeah, they used to make Pringles potato chips, which they're not potato chips, though. I don't know what they are, but they're not potato chips. They sold those. So here's a company based in Cincinnati, as I remember, yeah, that has been paying dividends for years, for decades, over 100 years, I think. And the current market price is $76.54 as of February 15th. 2013. They're currently paying $2.25 in annual dividends, and again, let's assume the dividends are growing at 8% a year. Our required rate of return is 13%. So if we run the numbers and we've done it enough times, let's do it again just to make sure, folks. I want you to do this. It's not that hard. Once you do it, some people are just afraid to put their fingers on the key on the calculator. I don't know why, but try it and you'll find that it's, hey, this isn't that hard. $2.25 times 1 plus 8%, 1.08, gives you 2.430. 13% minus 8%, 0.13 minus 0.08, gives you 0.05 or 5%. And that gives us 2.430 divided by 0.05 or 48.60. Well, Procter & Gamble does not quite measure up to our 13% required rate of return. All right, Procter & Gamble, let's take a look at you with a 10% rate of return. $2.25 times 1.08 gives us the same 2.430. Divided by 10%, 0.1, minus 0.08, 8%, or 0.02, and that gives us $121.50. The model says that Procter & Gamble is undervalued if we require only 10%. And my question to you is, are people all of a sudden going to stop using soap, toothpaste, diapers, toilet paper, shampoo, and shaving cream? Would you want to own Procter & Gamble? Did you do the 78 years ago handout in Chapter 5? Yeah, who was at the top of the list? Yeah. Slide 28. Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, that magical company that sells fizzy sugar water with a brown crayon dipped in it all around the world, makes 80% of their revenue outside the United States. You gotta know that Coke is charmed. They really are. In Mandarin Chinese, Coca-Cola sounds like happy drink. I mean, nobody, you know, they couldn't have done that ahead of time. I mean, unbelievable. Compare that to GM that exported the Nova to Latin America and didn't bother to ask anybody what Nova means in Spanish. It literally means it doesn't go. Nova. Yeah, right. Didn't anybody tell them? Anyway, let's get back to Coke. $37.42, 15 as of the 15th of February 2013, and they're currently paying $1.02 in annual dividends. Let's assume dividends again are growing at 8%, and if our required rate of return is 13%, I want you to do the calculation. You'll come up with $22.03. Well, so much for the caramel-colored fizzy sugar water, right? But what if our required rate of return were only 10%? Then we come up with $55.08. Very interesting. Yeah, maybe we ought to spend some more time researching Coke. And by the way, Mr. Warren Buffett owns a lot of Coca-Cola stock. In the United States, the average person drinks over 400 Cokes a year. Now, I have a hard time believing this, but some people drink, they drink it all day long. I don't like this stuff. I never liked it. People used to ask me as a kid, why don't you drink Coke? I don't like it. It makes my teeth feel weird. You should see what it does to teeth if you drop a tooth in there. It's got phosphoric acid in it. Supposedly it's good to clean the battery terminals on your car. But is Coca-Cola, are they thinking we're going to stay here in the United States? Hell no. In China, the average is 38 per year. Just 20 years ago, the average was 1. And in India, it is 12 per year. So you gotta know that the, and 10 years ago it was nothing. You gotta know that Coke is just saying, we can export this stuff all over the world and turn everybody into diabetics. Guess which country drinks the most? Not just guess, per capita, meaning per person. Ustedes que tienen parientes en México, ustedes saben la respuesta. You know the answer if you have family and friends who live in Mexico. Right, Mexico. They drink almost twice as much per person than the United States. We're third. It's Mexico, Chile, and then Chile, and then the United States. Yikes, folks! Yikes! 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 I mean, it amazes me that 400 Cokes per year in the United States. I don't drink any, so that means somebody's drinking 800. So it's an average. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. But is Coke a good? Has it been a very good investment over the years? Sure, go back to that 78 years ago. Sure, it has. Will it be continuing in the future? I don't know. If people start realizing what this stuff is doing to us, maybe it won't. I don't know. We'll find out. Slide number 29. General Electric. Another blue chip company, another member of the Dow. By the way, all these companies so far have been members of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The current market price is $23.29 as of 15th of February. They're currently paying 76 cents in annual dividend, and again, let's assume the dividends are also growing at 8%. At 13% required rate of return, the 13% required rate of return, our price that we would pay for GE is $16.42. Well, it doesn't look that great, does it? But if we reduce our required rate of return to 10%, then GE appears to be a great deal. Selling for $23, and we believe it's worth $41. But, folks, this is after General Electric dropped its dividend to 40 cents from $1.24 in 2009 after decades of growing the dividend. You see, people don't realize how diversified General Electric is. In the 2000s, up until the Great Recession, GE was making far more money from their financial arms, their financial businesses, than they were from their jet engines and their railroads and their power plants and their light bulbs and all the other old industrial things that they do. And they were hammered. They were just hammered. They had to stop increasing their dividend, which they had done for decades, and drop it, 60%? I'm sure it was a big blow to their egos. So what happened when things started coming back in 2010? They started raising the dividend again. First to 48 cents, then 56 cents, then 60 cents, then 68, and now to 76 cents per year. How's about that for a turnaround? Huh? Good for GE. And at the bottom of the market, who bought a ton of GE? You know who did. Mr. Warren Buffett, right? He's no dummy. The last one we're going to take a look at is Altria. Altria? You know them as Philip Morris. They used to be in the Dow, but I guess Dow Jones got a little bit guilty having a cigarette company in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Their current market price is $34.38 as of 15th of February 2013, and they're currently paying $1.76 in annual dividends. So let's assume dividends are also growing at 8% per year. If we have that required rate of return of 13%, then the formula yields $38.02. Whoopee! What a buy! Better than a 13% rate of return if you ignore the potential tobacco-related lawsuit damage and the fact that tobacco kills 400,000 Americans each year. Using this model, investors are currently requiring approximately a 13.53% required rate of return. Would you buy Altria? Would you buy a company whose products, when used as directed, kill their consumers? Well, as a matter of fact, yes, it's a very good... it's been one of the best stocks in history. Why? Because it costs them a little over a penny to make a cigarette. They put 20 of them in a box and sell for $7. So here's where social... We talked about... socially responsible investing back when we talked about mutual funds. Here's where you have to decide whether you're going to invest in Altria or Philip Morris International, which is the company they spun off that sells the cigarettes outside the United States, Would you buy Altria? Well, some people won't. They just say, no, I don't want anything to do with cigarettes. And other people say, hey, there are no secrets. We understand what's happening. That's what one gentleman who was interviewed by a very famous investor, Louis Rukeyser, on his show called Wall Street Week. And he knew the man was a Mormon, which they're morally against cigarettes. And he said, well, you're a Mormon, aren't you, sir? Yes, Mr. Rukeyser, I'm a Mormon. I'm a devout Mormon. And he says, and yet you're willing to invest in cigarettes? And he said, well, there are no secrets. People understand what's going on when they smoke a cigarette. And so I don't have a problem with that. I don't consume the product myself, but I am working on behalf of my investors, and this happens to be a very good investment. But then there are others who would counter and say, no, you don't understand. They go after 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds and younger folks because they know once people turn 18, 20, 25 years old, they're not going to start smoking. People start smoking when they're teens. And so, you know, the companies would, of course, deny this, but they're lying. I don't know if you remember, they're gone in the United States, but they're not gone around the world. The Camel Joe, or Joe Camel, or whatever he was called, cartoon character, before they started Camel Joe, this is Reynolds, it's their competitor, they had 1% of the 8 to 12 year market. They had 1% penetration in the 12 year old market. After they started Camel Joe, they had 32% of, yeah. Okay, anyway, so enough moralizing. Ask yourself, would you buy Altria? All right, let's continue. Hey, who's that? Who is that? Yeah, who is that? Who are you?
You know who it is.
Oh, it's my conscience.
Come clean
about what?
Fess up.
Fess up about what? I made them up. I made them up. All these companies are growing their dividends faster than 8%. I hate my conscience. The constant, slide number 31, the constant perpetual growth model is very sensitive to the assumed growth rate of dividends, just as it is sensitive to the required rate of return. And the recent dividend growth rates of Coke, Altria, Procter & Gamble, and Johnson & Johnson, and especially GE, are all currently higher than 8%. Altria, 8.2%, Coke, 8.5%, Johnson & Johnson, 8.7%, and Procter & Gamble has been growing their dividends at 9.7%. GE is over 20%, but that's a special exception. They're trying to come back to where they were in 2007. But the model does not work if the required rate of return is equal to or less than the dividend growth rate. Try it. You wind up with division by zero or negative prices. It just blows up. And for those of you who understand division by zero, it can't do it. So therefore, we should actually raise our expected rate of returns for all these companies. All are actually much better than what the model is telling us for our 10% or 13% rates of return. But note, these are blue chip companies with long histories of rising dividends. But they're not alone, folks. Check out ExxonMobil and McDonald's and United Technologies and Honeywell and 3M and Johnson Controls and Yum Brands. In fact, the bonus assignment for Chapter 6 wants you to look at these companies. And there are many of them out there that have been growing their dividends at 4%, 5%, maybe 8%, 9% a year. And what this says to me as an investor in mostly blue chip, large cap, they're called large capitalization, multinational companies that have business all around the world, is that the next 5 to 10, 15 years should be very good for stocks. Okay, come back in 5, 10, 15 years and you'll know whether or not Piano was right. Does it mean, is it a guarantee? No, it's not a guarantee. But it certainly does bode well for the future if we don't blow ourselves up, if Ebola doesn't become all the rage, if a meteorite doesn't hit, who knows? Global warming, warming, whatever it is. If these things don't destroy us, which, you know, then you never know, and we're able to continue as we're doing, it looks very bright for stock investors. Not going to explode on the upside, I don't know, but that's how it often works. Sometimes 1 year, like 1987, stocks will shoot up 40%, and then, of course, they fall 30%. But I am personally fairly confident that unless things go horribly wrong, stocks should return 8, 9, 10% over the next 10, 15 years or so. Come back in 10 years, see if I was right. Slide 32, the constant growth model. This assumes dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate for a specified number of years. And it's really the constant perpetual growth model with this added term to account for the growth for a number of years. Do you really have to know this? No. Forget it. This model takes the constant perpetual growth model one step further, adding a term to account for constant growth for a number of years. Just as the constant perpetual growth model evolved from the zero growth model, adding the additional terms to account for the constant growth of dividends. So, do you need to know this one? No. I'm not going to ask you. It's in the book. Go ahead and play with it if you're mathematically inclined. And then they take it even one step further, and it just gets, I think, ridiculous. The variable growth model, the two-stage dividend growth model, assumes dividends will continue to grow at a specified rate into the future, presumably the fast growth stage, and then grow at a secondly, presumable slower growth rate once the company matures, and you just keep adding more and more terms and making it look more and more college-like, very rigorous, and we're challenging our students. It's ridiculous. Many decades ago, Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's teacher, warned against using overly sophisticated mathematical models to value stocks. He just said, you know, it gives you the illusion of precision. And this model may look very impressive, especially to those who love math, but it has some very serious problems. It is difficult to accurately predict future dividend growth rates during the initial fast growth stage of a stock. Usually, companies do not pay significant dividends while they are growing quickly. So, do you need to know this formula? No, it's in the book, and notice I have like little nasty little things around it, so just stay away. So, let's regroup here. Ready? Take a little, stretch. Slide 34. Observations of the dividend discount models. How do you use them for companies that aren't paying any dividends? And the simple answer is, you can't. If the company's not paying dividends, its worth is zero to a dividend discount model. The constant perpetual growth model is usually unrealistic except for those small, rarefied companies that have been growing their dividends for many years. Dividend growth rates are very difficult to estimate. With large cap, well-established multinational companies, historical growth rates may be useful, but with fast-growing companies in new industries, it's almost impossible. The problems of the dividend discount models, notwithstanding, repeat after me. The value of a stock is based on the present value, of its future cash flows. In other words, what is this thing going to return to us in dividends? Now, the next version is called the discounted cash flow model. It's also called the dividends and earnings model. I don't know why, because it doesn't use earnings. Figure that one out. But it's really the pure form of the dividend discount model that we looked at the very beginning of the presentation. It uses the present value of expected dividends and the present value of the expected future price of the share of stock to value the share of stock. So in other words, we're not going to just look at the dividends. All the other models, we just looked at the dividends. Now we're going to look at what we expect the stock price to be in 3 or 4 or 5 years. So the formula is the value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends, which is the very first model we saw, right, that did not take into account the fact that the stock is worth anything, plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell. So get out those present value multipliers. Get out the table that we looked at the beginning of the presentation. It is not covered specifically in our text, which is a pity, because it's really just a pure form of the DDM, and it's certainly, I believe, the most powerful form, right? It's really just the pure form of the one that we looked at the very beginning, where we took dividend from year number one, dividend for year number two, dividend year number three, and then we used the fact that the stock is going to be worth something. The company's not going to go out of business, let's hope. As with the other dividend discount models, this model is very sensitive to our estimates and our choice of required rate of return, and hence, it's like predicting the weather, only worse. But I believe it gives us an edge. It tilts the odds in our favor, so to speak. So slide number 36. Example number one. Let's assume it is January 1st, 2013. Pretzels Unlimited is currently selling for $22 per share and will pay $2 per share in dividends in 2013. That's their symbol, expects to increase their dividends to $2.20 in 2014, $2.30 in 2015, and $2.30 in 2016. We will be selling the stock at the end of 2016, and we expect the price to be $27 per share at that time. Our required rate of return is 12%. So think about it. How are we going to do this? We're going to do what we did at the very beginning. We're going to take the present, we're going to take the dividend at year number one and multiply it times the present value multiplier for year number one at 12%. So go across 12% on the table down 1 year and you see 0.893, right? Make sure you do that. And then we're going to multiply the dividend for year number two, $2.20, times 0.797, which is the go across 12% down 2 years, and you see 797. I hope you do. Go across the 12% down 3 years, and you'll see 0.712. So $2.30, the dividend in year number three, times 7.712. Go across 12%, go down 4 years, and the $2.30 that we're expect to get in year number four is multiplied times 0.636. And then we believe that the stock will be worth around $27 at the end of our last year, 2016. So we again multiply it times the present value multiplier of 12% at 4 years, 0.636. Now you do all those calculations, and they're not hard to do, to multiply them and add them up, and you wind up with $23.81. The market is currently offering the stock at $22. So if our required rate of return is 12%, then this is not a bad deal for us. We think it's a pretty good stock to buy. Are you with me? Understand. If it were more than $23.81, we would say, I don't know. We'd have to lower our required rate of return. So let's build a spreadsheet, because I think it's easier to visualize and do the calculations. You see, it's the same thing we did on the previous slide, but we put the years over here, and then the cash flows, then the present value multipliers from the table, and notice in 2016 we've got a dividend, plus we have the price of the stock, so you use 0.636. Don't go down to year number five. These are given to us in this same year. So here is the problem in spreadsheet format. I think it is much easier to comprehend and calculate. Do you agree? Because it's the same thing we just did in the previous slide, but it is easier to comprehend, easier to do the calculations. So build that spreadsheet. But what I'm going to do is take it one step further on slide number 38. I'm going to combine the dividend in our fourth year with the expected price of the stock, $27, and put that in one calculation, one row, and it's more simplified, right? We only get four rows. So do you like this one? This is the one I hope you'll use. This is the one I hope you use because this is a whole lot easier, I think. And if you have a spreadsheet at home, folks, if you have a laptop or a tablet or whatever, or you're sitting at your desk at home on your desktop, you could build this spreadsheet in Excel or whatever spreadsheet you happen to use. I don't use those. I use something else, but whatever. Adding the dividend and the stock price in the last year saves us a couple of manual calculations. But more importantly, folks, here's the cool part. It also allows us to use a very special spreadsheet function to calculate the internal rate of return, slide number 39. Now, some of you might have heard of internal rate of return. You don't normally see it until you get to an upper level finance class or a graduate level finance class, but yours truly is sneaking it in here. Why? Because the spreadsheet does it for us. The internal rate of return is a measure of what rate of return we expect to get from a series of cash flows, including both positive and negative flows, income and outgo. Someday, when you take an upper level or graduate finance or investment class, you will learn how to manually compute internal rate of return. It's not fun. Hopefully, you will not have a sadistic professor who will require you to calculate it manually more than once. Doing it once is enough. That's why we have spreadsheets. We're simply going to enter the numbers into a spreadsheet formula and press the enter key. Is that okay with you? Yeah, I hope so. Enough. And there's a spreadsheet on the website that does Pretzels Unlimited. In other words, we required a 12% rate of return from Pretzels Unlimited, but the model is telling us that we're getting a better rate of return. What do our numbers tell us will be our expected rate of return? And so here's the formula. Here's the spreadsheet that uses the spreadsheet formula, and it's in Excel, you use IRR. In all of them, you use IRR. But in Excel, you use the equal sign. And then IRR, which stands for internal rate of return. And then you put the block of cells containing the cash flows. Now, we have to include what we paid out. We have to include the $22, which was the initial outlay, what the stock cost us in year zero, right now. In other words, time zero, what we have to pay for it. And then we're going to get $2 in 2013, $2 in 2014. In 2015, we expect to get $2.30. And then in 2016, we expect to get $2.30 dividend plus $27 from the proceeds from selling the stock. And we put that into the formula, internal rate of return, B2 to B5, cell B2 down to B5, and that's you started in the upper left-hand corner. And then the second value, which you could just leave it as zero, and the spreadsheet will try to figure out the answer, but that's what we guess. That's our guess as to what the internal rate of return would be. If you leave it zero, then what you're telling the spreadsheet is you go figure it out. But I think it's about 12%. And the computer comes back and says, oh, it's actually 14.5%. And sometimes, depending on the type of cash flows, it comes back and says, I can't figure it out, I give up, and then you have to change the guess and try to make it closer to what you actually think it is. So in the face-to-face class now, we would call up the spreadsheet and take a look at it. You can pause the presentation if you want or go back to it, go to it later, but it's on the website. It has the Excel spreadsheet. And a little commentary. Does it have a commentary? I don't remember. If it's not there, I'll put one. I don't know. Maybe not. Because here's the commentary. This is it. This is the spreadsheet right here. $22 we have to put out as an initial outlay. And these are that's the outgo. That's the cash flow out. And then the cash flows in are $2, $2.20, $2.30, $2.30, plus $27 of the sale of the stock. And it comes back, and the spreadsheet tells us that we're going to get 14.5%. What do you think? I am impressed, and I hope you are too. Jeans R Us, slide number 41, symbol GRUS, is currently selling for $21 per share, and it pays no dividends. It's one of those biotechnology companies based in San Diego that I've been suckers for, one of which is going to become the next Amgen or Genentech, the rest of which are going to become poopy. Anyway, we believe that Jeans R Us will sell for around $50 per share in 5 years. And our required rate of return, because it's a pretty risky stock, is 13%. How can we determine if this is a good investment? Well, with no dividends, which model can we use? It turns out that the discounted cash flow model, the dividends and earnings model, can still be used, folks. How? Well, remember, the formula is the value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell. Well, if there are no dividends, the value from dividends is zero. That's very easy. Zero times anything is zero. We're not getting any dividends, but we believe the stock's going to be worth $50 in 5 years. So at 13%, go across 13%, go down 5 years, and you'll find that the present value multiplier is 0.543. So you multiply the $50 that we think it's going to be worth in 5 years. We then multiply that times the present value multiplier for 5 years at 13%, and it tells us that the stock is worth $27.13. Unlike the other dividend discount models, the discounted cash flow model can still be used if there are no dividends. Very cool. But wait a minute, Piano. This is even more risky than the previous examples, because the previous examples were paying us dividends. These guys aren't paying anything. Oh, yes. This is what you're looking at, folks. These kind of companies can make you rich. $1,000 can become 50 grand. Or can become $50. That's the kind of risk you're taking. Do you understand now better? Sure, there are some people who will tell you about the Jeans R Us stock that went from $1.50 to $12 and made them rich. And they conveniently forget to tell you about all the other ones that went into the porcelain oasis and were flushed into the sewer. Is that going to happen with Johnson & Johnson or McDonald's or Coca-Cola? No, it's not going to happen with those companies. Every once in a while, Kodak comes along and disappears, but something else takes its place. But with these very speculative issues, we are really taking a strong gamble. And you as an investor have to know that. Cool. Okay. Slide number 42. The residual income model. This is another method that's a cousin of the DDMs. It's called the residual income model. It's in your book in the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions. It's not in the 3rd edition if you bought that. It allows us to value a company that is not paying dividends. So just like the discounted cash flow model, we can use it if they're not paying dividends. Instead of using dividends, the model uses earnings, and it's actually very similar to the constant perpetual growth model. We'll skip it for now. I don't know, maybe we'll come back to it later. It's really the constant perpetual growth model. I think you have enough on your plate as it is, don't you agree? And ditto for all the other models described in Chapter 6. So the ones in this presentation are the ones I want you to be able to do. And again, forget those ones that I told you to forget about. On the handout, there's a handout for formulas for Chapter 6. It highlights the formulas you need to know. The zero growth model, the constant perpetual model, and the discounted cash flow model. Those are the ones that I really want you to go through. Those are the ones that are we go through. And the price models, of course, from the previous presentation. They're on the worksheets. In the order, they're always in the same order. The companies are very similar. You always use a utility company for the zero growth model. So make sure you can do these. And I plead with you because some students say, "Yeah, no problem, Frank. I can do that. I'll do them." And then they do really well. And other students, they're just terrified. I don't know what it is. They're just they won't sit down and do them. You need to sit down and do them, and you'll do well. You will. And if you don't, you contact me, and we'll get together and do them. Okay, I need a break, right? Well, come on, we're in the home stretch. Just give me a few more minutes here, folks. Sources of information. Okay, Piano, this is all great, huh? But where are we supposed to get all this historical information anyway? And just who decides what next year's earnings will be per share, next sales per share, cash flow per share, dividends per share are going to be, let alone the expected price of the stock in 3 to 5 years? Well, before the internet, what should we start calling that, BI? This information was not readily available. Normally, you would ask your broker for it, or you would use one of the securities industry's trusted information sources, and traditionally, the most respected source was the Value Line. On line 44, folks, the Value Line. Still one of the most respected and trusted sources of data and analysis. Traditionally, it was often the only source many investors used for data and analysis, along with the company's materials that they would send you. But it ain't cheap, folks. It's very expensive. It's $600 a year, $50 a month, if you want them to send you the printed copies. And it might have come down. I haven't checked. But it's about $540 online. And go check out their website because they have some free freebies. Again, they're like Morningstar. They try to get you to sign up. But that's what libraries are for, folks. Southwestern has discontinued the Value Line to our dismay and sadness. But Chula Vista, Main Library has it. The Main Library of San Diego, many of the branch libraries have it. There's a link on our class website that shows you the libraries at the San Diego County libraries that have it. Yeah, many very respected people have always said great things about the Value Line. I'm a big fan of them. I love getting lost in the Value Line. That's just one of my favorite activities is go to the Point Loma Library, which is the closest one to where I live. I live in OB. And just get lost. just look at all these different companies. And that's the bonus assignment for Chapter 6. And there's a commentary for that, so listen to that. Especially their timeliness and safety indicators. One study, folks, which ignored transaction costs and tax consequences, only used their timeliness indicator. It showed how you would have beaten the market handsomely over a 20-year period by simply buying and selling stocks as they received and subsequently lost their number one timeliness designation. Of course, that's in the past. There's no guarantee that it will continue into the future. I'm not suggesting you do that. But it just showed that they're pretty good. They're pretty good at what they do. Slide 45. Now, in the book is an example of the Value Line from McGraw-Hill. And, of course, each edition has a different copy, because they come out with something every few months on the company. So you need to go look for the indicators, the projections, the historical data, the assets, the receivables, the inventories, the description and analysis of the business, historical annual rates, the insider institutional buying and selling, the amount of debt, the number of shares, the outstanding, the company's financial strength, its stability, price growth, earnings, predictability, ratings. Oh, my goodness, look at this thing. It is just... It's just a sip from the fire hose with all the information just stuffed in it. It's really pretty amazing. And so when you go back now and look at the dividend models and the price ratio models, now do you see where you can get this data? You can see where you can say, okay, well, what will the dividends be over the next 3 years? Well, here they go, folks. They're going to tell you. Well, of course, this was late 2009, but they're saying, look, Our dividends have been growing at a certain rate, and we expect them in 2014 to be $1.10. So they've gone from 90 cents up to $1.10. And what do you think about the price? Well, the price at this time was $28.73. Well, we believe in 2013 to 2014 that the price is going to be between $48 and $67. Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Remember, are they giving you guarantees? No. But sit down and just have a ball. Now, there's a cute little story about this. McGraw-Hill is the company that made your textbook, right? They're the ones that made actually your textbook. They're a very big media company. They own television stations and radio stations. They also own Standard & Poor's. You remember them, right? Standard & Poor's has their own competitive product to the Value Line. It's not as good. So you got to know that the authors were saying, no, we're going to use the Value Line. And the publishers at McGraw-Hill said, well, can't you use Standard & Poor's? It's similar. It's not as good. I wish I were the fly on the wall listening to that conversation. They wanted the Value Line, which is good. And here's the bottom, which does a pretty darn good profile and description of the business. And then they tell you their takeaway. These shares are untimely. The near-term picture is concerning, giving recent earnings shortfalls. But 3 to 5 year recovery potential is wide as of November 13, 2009. And then, these are all the earnings per share. They show you, they're going here, earnings per share and dividends going back in the last 5 years. So you understand how you can extrapolate. They've been growing their dividends at a certain rate, growing their earnings at a certain rate. Yeah, very cool. So let's put Value Line to the test, okay? In late 2009, the price of McGraw-Hill was $28.73. Their price prediction for early 2012 was in the range between, was between $48 and $68. On February 15, 2013, dear students, I'll fix that, McGraw-Hill's price closed at $44.95. So not bad. They were a little bit on the high side, but only a few months ago they were up over $48, $49, so not too bad. Actually pretty darn good. You know, I mean, think about it. When they made this prediction at the end of 2009, the stock market had rallied from the depths of the 2008-2009 crisis, but many people were still predicting the end of the world as we know it. And you know, some of them are still predicting the end of the world. Okay. Someday the world's going to end. We know that, okay? But they did a pretty good job. You know, they made a pretty gutsy call saying that things were going to get better and that McGraw-Hill was going to rise almost double, right? Almost double, 28 to 44. 68 would have been a high side. So let's take a look at the prediction from the fourth edition. All right, let's take a look at the fourth edition. Here's the fourth edition that was done in mid-2005. And what they were saying is by 2008 and 9, they expected the stock to be $64 to $80, $64.65 to around $80. Okay, what happened? All right, there's the bottom of it. You can read that if you want on the presentation. How did they do? Well, their price prediction for late 2009 was in the range of around $66 to $82. Yikes! McGraw-Hill's price was hovering around $24 in late 2009. What happened? Well, we know what happened. It reached $70 in mid-2007, so things looked pretty good. And then started falling as the credit market started reacting to the home mortgage loan crisis. Remember that McGraw-Hill owns Standard & Poor's. You've heard of the Standard & Poor's 500? And Standard & Poor's was also the company, one of the companies that were rating these bogus mortgage bonds, AAA, when people were just signing their names saying, oh yeah, I make $120,000 a year, when they only made $30,000. So Standard & Poor's was getting a whole lot of grief for that, which they deserved wholeheartedly. And McGraw-Hill, their parent company, plummeted as the home mortgage loan crisis spread to the entire financial sector in 2008 and then to the entire economy. Their mid-2007 prediction, of course, right before, from the fifth edition of the text, was even uglier. Yeah. But I was reading the value line, as I do anyway, in 2008 when things started to really look bad. And it was pretty scary. They were saying things like, well, you know, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good, but we're hoping for the best. It really doesn't look good. Things are really looking bad. And then when it started falling like crazy, they were saying, folks, you know, this is huge. This is horrible. And they got caught flat-footed like everybody else. Slide 52. Here's the one from the third edition. So, this is the one they did the best. This is where they bang on the money, folks. In early 2003, the stock was at $54. Wait a minute. What happened? They split. You know, because you have to drop that in half. And they expected it to be between 90 and about 110 or so, right? And so there's the bottom. You can read that if you are so inclined. And on slide 54, in early 2003, the value line predicted that the price of McGraw-Hill would be around $90 to $110 in 2005 or 6. Wait a minute. Why so much higher? That's because they split the stock 2-for-1. So you have to divide the prices by 2 to compare them to the previous 2 predictions. Hooray for the value line! They were bang on the money. McGraw-Hill reached $120 level by the end of 2006, which would be a $60 split adjusted. You know, I get a kick when some investors trash the value line and trash Warren Buffett and say they're old-fashioned and they're fuddy-duddies. They make mistakes, too, just like everybody else, but I would sure love to see how those investors' long-term results stack up against the long-term results of the value line. Who do you think would have the better results? I know who I put my money on. So, we are finished with Chapter 6, folks, and you now are one of the gurus. You now see an investment. And don't just look at it as a mere speculation of what will it be worth 10 years from now or 10 months from now or 10 days from now. You don't say, as Mr. Boggle said, I think I can buy it at 10 and sell it for 12 or 20 or 100. You look at an investment as a series of cash flows. And what are those cash flows worth to me today? Now, having done all these calculations, after you have done them and have said, oh, yeah, I think this is a good investment, oh, yeah, I think this is not a good investment, I want you to then throw them all away. Seriously, I want you, after you have done them, you need to destroy them out of your mind. You know, they've pointed you in the right direction. But then you need to ask yourself, would I really want to own this company? Sure, the model says Johnson & Johnson looks pretty good. Value line says it's going to be, you know, a whole bunch higher in 3 or 4 years, 5 years. Do I really want to own Johnson & Johnson? Maybe yes, maybe no. Do I want to own Coca-Cola? Do I want to own Altria or Philip Morris International? Do I want to own that incredibly speculative biotechnology company which is going to revolutionize the world and become fabulously famous and wealthy, or go down into the trash? And that's what Peter Lynch says to do. He says, after you've done all your analysis, ask yourself, would you want to own this company? And now also you see the 3 to 5 year time frame that we talked about when we talked about mutual funds, and we said you're looking for a mutual fund that has a turnover rate of about 20-25%, because on average you want to think in terms of a 3-4-5 year turnover. You know, you check them, you're checking your companies continually, but you're seeing how the next 3 to 4 to 5 years looks, and that's what Value Line does, and that's what I believe the good investors do. So thank you for persevering. Go back over this and do it again, folks. You're going to be the expert. You're going to be the intelligent investor. Cool. When we come back in Chapter 17, we're going to learn about ratio analysis. They call it projecting cash flow and earnings, but we're going to key on the ratio analysis.
But this is the heart of the course, folks. What you've just learned in this chapter, discounted cash flows, dividend discount models, present value of future cash flows. Go back and do it again. Twice. And then a third time. See ya!